Thank you.
And in paragraph 3.2 of the rhythm, you talk about the absence of any LR or other equivalent threshold. It's important that the so-called rule gateways, otherwise referred to in the evidence as drafting gates, are established in a way that exposes correction for one farm's activity status has appropriate relativity to another as regards the risk of contaminant loss. And so Ms. Maher, although in a different discipline, in the discipline of planning, has discussed what she considers the word risk to be broken down into. And she considers it's the likelihood of a discharge as well as the consequence of the discharge. Would you agree with that? Because that relates to the should be, when you deal with this elsewhere in evidence, a different approach to risky environments such as the vulnerability on wetland, but that is perhaps more of a question for planning.
Okay.
In paragraph 3.3 of the evidence, you concur with the evidence of Mr. Brockstock that concludes that the NRS includes all management factors that would commonly contribute to nitrogen loss risk within a dairy farm system, and that in the absence of others here, it's the only practical option available.
It's all on my 3.3 seats.
Oh, sorry, it's 3.33.
Yes, that's right.
Do you have a problem with retaining the overseer NLLR as a risk gateway? Do you think though that overseer is the best way, still the best way to estimate risk of leaching at the root zone?
Well, overseer doesn't estimate the risk, overseer estimates loss, or estimates loss. So, I mean, risk and loss are different things. In the science review, not seeing my long and stock exposed there, the science review panel has raised concerns about being used in registry settings, so I think that's why it's not being used today.
Yeah, so Mr. Travolco, in particular, as I understand it, raised the issue with OCF following the OCF review panel report, which, as you know, says, will caution against the use of overseer as an absolute number in the planning documents. But as a gateway, it wouldn't be used as an absolute number, would it?
No.
And do you You say there are no other practical options available. Are you familiar with the option that's being developed in the Horizons region, which is another risk matrix that takes into account biophysical factors? Do you see that there might be problems if we have different matrices or scorecards developed throughout the country, particularly for persons in your discipline?
Oh, well, I think consistency would be fantastic. I can think of examples across my professional practice where having one consistent measure for everything would be fantastic, but that's not the reality that we live in, unfortunately. So I think that the ability to do so would be the reason we don't have it at the moment. So I think it's just a necessary factor to really that we have multiple tools on trying to do the same thing.
In that respect, though, doesn't Overseer still provide us with the best tool because it works in a pan farming environment?
So I think that depends on how you view its limitations. I mean, certainly the as the other ones have talked about, Overseer is a significantly more complex tool than the other drafting gateways that are in use at the moment, and that does provide a significant hurdle for its use. It's also quite data intensive, so I think the reality is that there was a reason why it was considered an American tool originally, but I think the world's moved on a lot since then, and it is simply a tool that could have some utility.
So it depends on how you're trying to use it.
I think so. So I'm not sure the best I can say that it turns out as the best tool. I think it can be a useful tool.
It's the best tool, though, isn't it, for estimating annuals?
It's the only tool. Well, that's not quite true. I mean, it's probably the most accessible tool for estimating annuals at the root zone. It's the only tool that can be used to get advice on without a pH. There are other options, right? Like Spasmo and Apsin, but they're not tools that are able to be used really by anyone who's not had years and years of training and other slow their application each time.
Thank you. You'd be familiar with the cost of a farmer obtaining an Overseer nutrient budget?
I am.
Now, we've had a cost figure mentioned, I think it was in the first week of the hearing, of up to $10,000. So my understanding is that you pay an annual fee for Overseer EVM?
Yes, this annual subscription cost, correct.
And can you remind me of that figure?
It's $760 per annum at the moment.
And my understanding also is that consultants charge $200 or so an hour, or maybe $250.
It depends. So I can only speak for what we would charge for that, and it depends also around the application. So if someone's using an Overseer budget as a farm decision-making tool, it has for us significantly less requirement for down to the last T crossing accuracy. That can be a lot less. So if you're doing it for compliance purposes, to a full standard auditability over multiple years, then it can be quite an expensive task. But I think just as you will, I think a fee somewhere in the vicinity of $200+ an hour would be a pretty typical rate for a farm professional advisor to charge for their services.
And the number of hours that you need to spend would be reduced if a farmer is familiar with the inputs that they need for Overseer.
Primarily around whether the farmer, the quality of the farmer's data was in a format that was easily accessible. I can give examples in my evidence of what a well organised set of data can turn out in terms of time requirement. At the end of the day, if you go to your accountant with your zero subscription versus the sugar sack for the invoices, the time's quite different.
Are you familiar with the practice that's developed around Lake Rotorua with the regime that's Bay of Plenty Regional Council?
Yes.
So my understanding that once the farmers around that may have been quite familiar with the data inputs that are required, an Overseer file could be developed between $1,000 or $2,000? You said that you were involved in the early stages of the nitrogen risk scorecard as a peer reviewer. And I wanted to ask you a few questions around the Abacus bio report.
I'll do my best to run all the way.
Do you have it there?
I do.
It was attached to the evidence in chief, Ms. Allen. The Abacus fire report undertook a comparison of the Fonterra in risk scorecard against OCEA and against the N surplus.
Mm-hmm. Yep, sorry, so it was put in against both the N surplus taken by OCEA and the N loss taken by OCEA, that's correct.
Thank you. And if we go to page 22 of the report, now, at the beginning of giving your evidence, you see that the findings in this report are consistent with what you would expect. And in the discussion and recommendations, we see OCEA N loss to water has been used as the main variable of interest in this analysis to determine how the N scorecard sub factors influence such.
Yep.
And the last sentence says prediction accuracy is much higher for OCEA N surplus compared to OCEA N loss, as there are many environmental variables, e.g. rainfall temperature, soil type, elevation, slope, etc., that contribute to nitrogen loss that are not incorporated into the N scorecard. And so that's why you said that the findings were consistent with what you would expect.
Yes.
And then if we go to Appendix 1 to the report, which has Table 1.1, analysis of farms without irrigation, Table 1.2, analysis of farms with irrigation, and then Table 1.3, all farms. The model R value for N loss was under 50% for all of these three examples. And so I've just written this down because I'm not a statistician, but if the R2 of a model is less than 50% and approximately half of the observed variation can be explained by the model's inputs. And so the other half can't. So that is not a particularly good prediction accuracy. We're comparing apples to oranges. Now, if I can go and say to paragraph 6.8 of your evidence. And this relates to the policy requirement for reducing diffuse loss of NP sediment And so I'm not quite sure what EFO is.
E. coli
to water to EFO is practicable. And you raise some concerns here with being able to have some objectivity around that analysis.
Probably more around consistency around that analysis.
Consistency, okay. And if we scroll down, in 6.11 you say, in context of PC1, it seems some form of implementation guidance or practice note would be required to improve the interpretation of this concept by farmers and practitioners alike, primarily to avoid any perception or expectation of farmers committing to only the bare minimum or the regional council expecting unreasonable actions. And then in 6.12 you raise some issues that you consider might be in a guidance note? Or
no, I don't know if this is just more or less my initial take on how I would approach the concept of being of lowest practicable from the perspective of demonstrating that concept in a data plan.
Right. Thank you. And in 6.12b, you suggest having the farmer's cost to implement expressed as a percentage of the annual farm revenue to identify the relative affordability of actions.
Yeah, I'm not saying that could be one of the options.
So, in regards to the policy framework, in the first week of this hearing, I asked Mr. Trevelco about how he would assess the financial viability of different actions that are potentially required on farms. And he said he wouldn't be requiring farmers' balance sheets, but he would be having a conversation with the farmer. Now, Ms. Ma has considered this issue as well, and she has proposed reading along the lines of the financial aspect gets considered according to the scale of the farm business. So if it's a larger business, they might be able to do more if it's the farm scale, say.
I guess so, or a farm is more profitable, they can do more.
Do you consider that there should be more direct criteria like that placed in the planning document?
Do you mean to that be prescribed by council, or do you mean it should be included in the justification by a certifier and a farmer around the actions that farmer will take?
If it's to be in a farm planner's justifications, I'm suggesting that should be flagged from the plan as to how you go about this assessment. So the plan itself would provide that guidance.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd probably be using those measures to try and demonstrate why certain actions are going to take longer to be achieved, maybe than that otherwise. So, the questions I've been asked earlier on around the timing of mitigation being put in place, the realities of a farm has to put, a significant amount of capital works. It's going to be impossible for them to implement in a single year, so that would be a justification for why you would maybe take a staged approach in the farm environment plan to undertake those actions. I'm not sure that this is always a tension for these documents. You need them to be flexible enough to be tailored to a farm business versus things like prescriptive that you need a second degree to use them. So, it's one of those things on balance. I think that we have guidelines for certifiers around that stuff that will improve that, but whether you need an absolute certain assessment, every single action needs to be fiscally justified before taking the step.
Okay, so there's going to be an immediate.
I hope so.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Thompson. I thought Ms. Omni would take you to the house. I'd also like to take you back to it, please, and it's on in the executive summary, it's on page 3 of that report. And in the third paragraph, second line, it says the moderate accuracy of prediction of overseer end loss to water from the scorecard sub-factors is encouraging. When you're talking about the accuracy that you were talking about before, 40% predictability, I am a little bit surprised at that statement in the executive summary. Do you have a comment on that?
Well, I suppose that ultimately the loss of water is a combination of the incidents in the farm business and biological environments. And so the ultimate loss of water is somewhat hard to explain by the incidents, by the amount of imbalance being lost, and the balance is made up by the loss or the biophysical parameters of the farm system, which aren't included at all in the endless scorecard. So it kind of makes sense to me.
So it's really the things like rainfall that you're talking about.
Rainfall and the inherent drainage capability of the soil.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's helpful, thank you. In terms of your comment about linking the risk scorecard to what happens in the environment, the effects of that, for the risk scorecard to be taken further than just a drafting gate, would you say that information, that link, has to be established?
I'm not even sure whether it could actually be taken much beyond the drafting gate. The minute you start to require it to be linked to biophysical, you're actually using that as a tool for allocation, for example, like looking at it inextricably linked to the sea environment. Mm-hmm. So you'd be a tool that's just as handy in the school how it currently provides for. I think it would be reasonable to put further empirical evidence to start to understand around whether there were receiving environments that could withstand greater levels of risk relative to others. But if you're just taking it much beyond a drafting gate or maybe a nuanced drafting gate, it's not the right tool. You need to have a clear link to the bias of the
So in a situation where you might have to reduce the nitrogen in the catchment by 37%, would you think it would have any application in the
other? Look, it could be a proxy for a complex process. It's probably a better proxy than simply a blanket input control on, say, fertilizer, but it's not as specific as you're actually trying to make sure that the amount of N that actually hits the receiving environment is down by 30% once again you get to the other link, the soil conditions and so on into that pathway.
Okay. So in terms of the possibility of keeping overseer in the plan chain, is that something that if people work through the overseer issues, that overseer could possibly be used to that in the future?
I pointed out once again, and that's too much. But I mean, it's conceptually it's a tool that could be used, but once again, it has some limitations in terms of its ground truthing. The science review panel identified that in some areas it was potentially a very good best indicator of likely loss being to the same environment. In other soil types, it was not. So, I probably. I think we need a lot more work before we provide absolute confidence in every situation to be used in a way that can actually allocate.
No, that's fair, thank you. And just trying to get an idea of where the nitrogen is coming from in the catchment. There's an estimate of something like 3,000 tons or something of anthropogenic nitrogen that has to be reduced. Where is that coming from between dairy and dry stock? Have you done any work on that?
No, all the work that we've been done has been pretty heavily reliant on overseer.
Okay.
So I probably would have that information to hand.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Your Honour.
Thank you. Mr. Matheson, have you read or heard the evidence of Dr. Olivota?
No, I have not.
He was working on an in broad terms, he reaches an overall conclusion that, at least for the dairy sector, a consequence of trying to achieve the outcomes, the objectives of PC1 will mean that there'll need to be a reduction in number of stock units on dairy farms, a substantial reduction in terms of nitrogen use, however that might be achieved, a reduction in imported feed, and probably some ancillary controls on the area utilised for dairy production, which he says in overall terms might reduce farm profit by about 5% and bring nitrogen leaching down by about 30%. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about the drafting gates and a lot of talk about how the various measures might go into running this, but in terms of what the actual impact might be out there on the farms, have you given that any consideration, and is there otherwise any reaction that you can offer us in terms of what Dr. Olivoda says that his modelling indicates?
So I haven't taken any modelling at scale for the Plan Change 1 reactions. You know, I have given prepared evidence in the past, let's say, the Bush reaction.
Yes.
On that very factor. I can't comment directly on Dr. Olivoda's work, but ultimately, look, you know, the first reductions are always the cheapest. And so you would expect that, you know, if we're looking at a 20% reduction, and by 20% is of the way of achieving the outcomes of this, we need a 20% reduction in nutrient load. But certainly you would expect the costs to be less impactful in this plan change and in the subsequent ones.
I see. Even though there's still a desire to try and get 20% of the gains, I suppose, in the first 10 years to try and get a move on.
Yeah, look, it depends, Your Honour, because I mean, ultimately, most of the evidence suggests that to achieve reducing farm intensity in most circumstances results in reduction in profitability.
Sure.
The only chance we have, of course, is it's not the only thing that farmers are also adapting and responding to. So the reality is that we face the likelihood of emissions that are not being wanted to be priced. We have biodiversity to consider. We have a number of other factors that wash in and out of the situation. As you'll be very, very, very familiar with, Your Honour, the level of debt servicing has a big impact on that as well. So, look, do those numbers feel about right? Would they feel like they'd be in the ballpark of that without actually reviewing his work specifically out there?
No. Well, I appreciate that not having had that opportunity, but in terms of the work that you generally do for agricultural consulting, it is a question of whether you think it is within the ballpark or not.
I think farmers are pretty innovative, so in a general sense, I think that the capacity of the farming community to respond to these challenges is probably usually underestimated by that level of model.
Right.
So often these things, you know, up things come along that allow us to do better things in a better way. But I think, the reality you change the assumed price of that analysis,
yeah,
and all of a sudden the costs double.
Well, indeed. And there are aspects of that outweigh beyond the ability of the regional council or this court or anyone else to influence.
So this one, the work that I've done over at the time, in general terms, the first 5 to 10% from a nitrogen point of view, the first 5 to 10% of nitrogen reduction, tends to be cost neutral in my experience, and then costs ramp up after that.
The low hanging fruit.
The low hanging fruit gets picked first, but the reality is we're running out of fruit.
Right. But the other point that you're making, and just to be sure that I understand this, dairy farming is not the only possibility on or in these catchments.
Well, it's well, quite specifically, no, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
most of the other alternative land uses we have at current, we have lower levels of profitability than dairy farms. And you know, we can strain under both national regulations and Queensland one itself around more intensive use. So commercial production is probably a land use which has a lot of potential utility on land that's currently used to dairy farm, but this is never been strained for a number of reasons.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the milk price is one thing, but there's the cost of getting the milk product to market.
There's also the cost, not just on the farm in terms of the capital that's been invested in those systems, it's also the capital on the wider community. So
yes.
The supply chains that exist to transport all that product, so it's not as simple as simply turning them off one day and starting with something else. So it's a longer term impact around transition if we move from system to one system.
Thank you very much for your evidence, Mr. Davis.
Good afternoon, Your Honour, members of the court, Beacon Land Court, Andrew Neil Burt. Is your name Andrew Neil Burt?
Yes.
And are you the Chief Economist at Beacon Land New Zealand Limited?
Yes.
And did you prepare a brief of evidence dated 28 July 2023?
Yes.
And do you have the qualifications and expertise set out in that brief of evidence? And did you attend joint witness conferencing that resulted, joint witness conferencing for economics and modelling, which resulted in a joint witness statement dated 5 September 2023?
Yes, I did.
And that joint witness statement represents your expert opinion in accordance with the Environment Court's Code of Conduct?
Yes, it does.
Do you have any corrections you wish to make to either your evidence or that JWS?
No corrections, only small addition.
Okay, we can get to that shortly. So, given there are no corrections, do you confirm that your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief, and the joint witness statement represents your expert opinion?
Yes.
So you mentioned a moment ago that there was one addition you wanted to make to your evidence in chief.
Yes.
Does that relate to your paragraph 96? And for the court's reference, that is found at page 307.0048 of the bundle. Just give the court a moment to find that.
So what was the paragraph number?
96. What is the addition you wish to make to that paragraph?
You started describing the farm classes there, and just occurred to me when reading farm classes 4 and 5 that we should add farm class 3, a description of farm class 3, Hard Hill Country. That description is identified in the appendix. And refers to steep hill country, lower stocking rate in general terms, and selling a lot of stock as store stock as distinct from prime stock. It occurred to me that
And you say there's a reference in an appendix. Can you just tell us the page number?
And you've been in court today, haven't you, Mr. Burt?
Yes.
And did you hear Mr. Berry say that he was a farm class 4 farm, or his properties were?
No, he was not in court at that time.
Ah, right. So if you take it from me that Mr. Berry was a farm class 4 farm, can you tell me how many farm class 4 farms there are in the Waikato Bay of Plenty region according to the Beef and Land Economic Survey?
Well, we focus on farm businesses, it's about over 1,000 of those.
And one final question before I ask you to remain for any questions from my friends in the court. How would you characterise the returns from dry stock farming?
Quite variable.
Right, and what has been happening in recent years?
Well, in recent years, there's been a sharp decline in revenue and profitability.
And are there any numerics or other figures that you can provide the court as to what the changes have been over the last little while?
The last week we published an outlook for 2023-24 that at a national New Zealand level there was a 31% decline in profitability compared with 22-23, and 22-23 was a 32% decline from 2021. So over that 2 years, there's a 50% decline in farm profitability.
And have you published any data on inflation on farm?
Well, I mentioned inflation earlier, and yes, earlier in the year we did a regular on-farm inflation report, and that came up with a figure for the 2022-23 year in March of 16.3%.
You just said, just for the record, you just said you mentioned inflation earlier. Do you mean in answers to my questions or in your evidence?
Both.
Thank you. Remember, you are for any questions from my friends for the court.
No, thank you, sir.
And I'm junior legal counsel for the Director General of Conservation. Just have an initial question for you regarding paragraph 94B of the evidence. That's at 3.0.0.6. So in that paragraph, am I correct in understanding that you're saying 80% of a farm is grazable, while the other 20% provides goods and services that are not directly related to production of food and fibre, such as ecosystem services? That's your evidence?
Yes, on average.
On average? Yes, I see that. I
just want to make that clear that this is necessarily duplicity around the average.
Correct. And I see that clarification there. So, based on the evidence, it is conceivable that some or all of the land which is to be set aside for setbacks is not grazable.
It's possible that some is.
And if that's the case, then doesn't that mean that the opportunity cost of any land loss setbacks will be minimal because the land is not grazed anyway. Except that, just to clarify the question there, that it's not going to be all the land lost to setbacks, it's not going to be 100% graceful. I have a question now regarding paragraph 108, which is at 307.057.
Sorry, Councillor, what's the second
one?
108?
108, paragraph 108, page 57. So in paragraph 108, you've noted that over time farms have become more efficient as a result of adapting their businesses.
Yes.
So by way of example, adapting to prices for their products and inputs.
Yes.
And that how adaptable nitrogen fertilizer, would that be an example of the input cost?
Yes, that would be an input cost.
Is it a big cost, nitrogen fertilizer?
Fertilizer is a large cost, yes.
So actions to reduce the input or the volume of nitrogen fertilizer can decrease the cost, farm costs.
But all other things being equal in relation to the price. Which depends on both price and quantity.
And you know, farms adapt and are adapting. And another example is adapting to regeneration.
Yes.
So you'd similarly expect that farms would adapt to the PC provisions, PC1 provisions. And if farms are able to be adapt or easily adaptable to move their businesses, then we should be less worried about the costs of the proposed provisions.
You included the word easily adaptable, yes.
So that was probably a word that was meant there, but essentially they do adapt and they are adapting to other regulations and changes in price and costs. Constantly changing. Thank you, I've got no good questions.
Thank you, Ms. Richard. Mr. Pennell?
Just one question. Did you do any reviews of Dr. Olivode's economic evidence?
Briefly, but some months ago.
Okay, that's fine. I guess I won't have any questions. Thank you.
And I have no questions. Thank you very much for your evidence. Oh, anything arising?
Thank you.
Thank you for your evidence.
I find myself in a position now where we're a little bit ahead of where I thought we'd be.
Well, I'm very glad to hear.
Yes, as well. Likewise. So my next witness is Dr. Crystal.
Yes.
Ideally, I prefer not to hold her over overnight, and there's a little bit more work I'd like to do with her overnight in terms of rethink some of the questions.
I was actually just thinking that given the nature of her evidence and the my expectation that there may be quite a few deep-lasting questions, I wouldn't want her hung up on cross-examination either. What I would just inquire of you and counsel generally is an overall view about where we stand in terms of timing. I think we perhaps got off to a little bit of a slow start, which was to be expected. It seems to me that we are tracking reasonably well at this stage. I don't know, Mr. Conway, what you think of where we are overall in the schedule?
Yes, thank you, Your Honour.
You're in charge.
This is not you, you're welcome to.
I think that's right, sir. We have some remaining witnesses for Beacon Lane and Ferrier Farmers.
Yes.
Which we should complete tomorrow.
Yes.
If you want to work Astral. And then that'll see us through until probably sometime on Thursday, maybe a little more, maybe a little less. But at this rate, I've been wondering if we might finish before the end of Friday with the witnesses who are on the list for this week. And at that point, we have a decision on whether there's anyone else who gets put forward or whether we're comfortable overall. And I'm probably in the latter category that we need assistance.
Well, I might just double check. Ms. Carruthers and Ms. Omri, you're all set and best estimate. We'll get through your witnesses, certainly, Ms. Carruthers.
Yes, sir. Warwick and Pastor was all set to go. I had anticipated that Stephen and his farmers may take longer, so I've arranged my team to be in full attendance from Thursday. So if by some stroke we get through the five remaining witnesses who've been claiming feds tomorrow, my request would be to start first thing Thursday rather than kick off tomorrow if that's possible.
Well,
but I don't anticipate taking, but it depends on my friends how long I take. We'll definitely be done before the end of Friday. Hopefully the end of Thursday we'll all get a super long May weekend. But
just on that, Your
Honour. Yeah, well, I was just going to come to you, Ms. Omri, and about how your place and your witnesses.
Yes, so I'm actually scheduled to commence on the 6th of November.
Oh.
Have you got the old timetable?
I have the old timetable in front of me, which is what I've been working off and making plans on and so on.
Right. Well, the fishing day place is now scheduled for the 6th of November.
All right, I'll just put a mark in there.
If you do want to proceed on Friday, I'm actually not ready to proceed with my legal submissions, but I could call some witnesses, but I've spoken to my friends who say they haven't prepared for that. So.
Well, no. Look, I actually think
so if it assists, the schedule as I understand it has Wairaki going after Feds and Beacon Land,
yes.
And then Kamu, who have since advised that they simply wanted to table their submissions that they've already filed. So
yes.
I should be there.
When we've got those submissions. And then we've got Fish and Game now in the week of the 6th back here, Horticulture New Zealand. Together with Pukekohe Vegetable Growers Association, and that's essentially a combined case.
Essentially,
yes. All right. And then iwi, CNI, iwi land management, Mr. Ferguson.
Yes, and I'm still having a discussion about the extent to which that's combined or two separate submissions.
No, that's all right. And I don't know if you've had any recent discussions with your friend, Mr. Majuri.
I've just ended the communication. I suggest that you turn up and find out.
Well, thank you for regaling us.
Still appreciate it. I was keen to be in that week. Reserve week in case we slip over.
Well, we do have the reserve week. On the other hand, I suspect that nobody wants us to slip for no good reason. But on the other hand, if we have Fish and Game, Horticulture New Zealand and the Pukekohe Growers, and then River Iwi, CNI Iwi, and then Iwi of Hauraki, that doesn't seem impossible to achieve within week four.
No, I agree. It seems achievable.
Yes. Okay. All right. Well, that's fine then. Then I think makes sense to the end tomorrow in terms of where we're heading. And of course, we've got the discharge, point source discharges to run separately. In terms of the timing for that, we put down 2 days. That all seemed a bit short to me, but do you think that's still reasonable? 24 and 25 October.
So I would hope it is, but at the moment, now that we've received legal submissions from the other parties for that, we're compiling an updated list of issues so that we can be in a position to confirm just how many issues are outstanding.
Yes.
And perhaps I'll review that in the next day or two, and if there's any update, I will let you know. But at this stage, I would hope, given the number of witnesses on that list and the degree of combination between the parties, 2 days might be enough, but I hope it is.
All right. Well, we'll do our very best. In any event, now, is there anyone else who wants to raise anything procedural or otherwise housekeeping matter at this stage, Ms. Omri?
Yes, sir. The commencement of the hearing, I did raise the interest of Forest and Bird.
Oh, yes.
I attempted to get in touch with Mr. Anderson yesterday, and I haven't managed to make contact with him. So I will
leave. He and Mr. Majuri might want to present a joint case.
That's right. Well, I'll let you know on that, sir.
All right, if you would. There are no specific Forest and Bird witnesses, are there?
What the nature of his submissions are going to be, and I'm not sure the extent to which this is still an issue, was the case law on section 293.
Oh dear.
And it doesn't relate, of course, to the...
Sounds like week 6 to me.
Yes, it was not going to be related to the farm ban issue or the stock exchange exclusion, but it's solely related to this overseer issue. So, yes.
Seriously, I think that at this stage, and subject to anything that any party may wish to raise, including for Forest and Bird, in our discussions and after consideration of a range of different things, and as I think I indicated some time ago, we want to hear some of the evidence before we turn to look at whether section 293 was required. We don't think that it's obvious that section 293 is required at this stage. If any, and largely that comes down to, and I think it was summarised by Mr. Matheson reasonably accurately, all of the affected parties are generally represented, and certainly we don't think that there is a clear need to remove overseer from the framework. The question is how it should be dealt with. That seems to us to be within scope.
Yes, sir.
Now, that's just an indication to try and assist, whether that assists Mr. Anderson or not, and whether you want to be the one who bears that news to him. And if you otherwise be welcome to contact with the court, we can address that.
Thank you, sir. I don't.
Thank you for reminding us that Royal Forest and Bird are, in fact, a party.
Yeah. I will have that discussion with Mr. Anderson, and I think those comments might assist with my discussion. So, thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Just one final minute. It relates to next week's hearing, and we had a discussion, I think, back in Auckland regarding for Mr. Bright to be able to put some questions, which is because there's been an indication from the police OG and the territorial authorities for some questions. Obviously, ABL is available, and Mr. Bright would prefer to be there in person. That's his preference to be there in person if it's available. So I'm just going to liaise with my friends.
Yes.
About time for that.
Yes.
I am fortunate in my high court trial next week.
I would encourage all council to put your heads together, and in particular, given that we have 2 days scheduled, I think there is the possibility of some run-on time available. We will be in the court in Auckland, so we do have full APL facilities up there. As we generally do, we can accommodate people out of order if that makes the timetable work better for them and for us. Thank you, Mr. Kirby. Nothing else? No, all right. Well, we'll adjourn again until tomorrow morning, 9:30. Start with Dr. Crystal at 9:30. Mr. Thompson, thank you very much. We'll reorganise ourselves, so please, you're on your own.
I'm going to go to the next one. Sorry, I'm going to do it.